Come on in and line up for your questions. Okay, let's break it up here. No, I don't think it's a problem. Trying to get y'all up here, yeah.
We're going to put both y'all on the platform. Yeah. But we're working at it.
Okay, find your seat or line up for questions at the mics. And ask your question and say who you want to answer it. If you want both of them to answer it, say both. That's spelled B-O-T-H. Okay, we'll start with Tom McCall. Go ahead.
Yes, may I say to our Israeli friend, I think that's one of the most optimistic messages that I've heard in a long time.
Yeah.
Yes. I have understood that another area of Texas and Israeli cooperation has been in the field of petroleum and so forth.
In the Leviathan field and in the fracking.
Could you say a word about what's going on in Israel on that?
In oil and gas.
Well, certainly the breakthrough in Israel's exploration of natural gas, hopefully oil as well, has been led by a Houston-based company, Noble Energy. It started the more significant exploration, offshore exploration, by 2017. We hope to become net exporter of natural gas. According to Noble Energy, there are positive signs of oil deposits underneath the natural gas, which, if proven, and it hasn't been proven yet, would catapult Israel to further heights. And at this stage, in 2013 and 2014, the expectations are that natural gas exploration will contribute 1% additional to the economic growth of Israel, which without natural gas is around 2.83% economic growth. As a result, there are other countries which are interested. I know that Italy is already in partnership with Noble Energy, so is a Norwegian company, so is an Australian company, which is still negotiating, but those are major, major global giants in the area of natural gas. And hopefully this will catapult us to new heights. But as far as your comment about my message being optimistic, I absolutely deny it. I'm not optimistic, I'm not pessimistic, I'm a realist. And what I've done here, I've shared with you what I believe to be well-documented data on reality. And I suggest that anyone here in this room and anyone you meet when you go back to your different towns, talk them into going to Israel to find out that this reality is much, much, much more positive than media headlines. As far as tourism, I live in Jerusalem, and I can tell you that on one hand I complain about tourism because it has made traffic in Jerusalem next to unbearable. But on the other hand, I know it's a blessing to Israel. So I recommend that you partake in that visit to Israel, which will expose you to another dimension of media misrepresentation of the Middle East.
Are there plans in Israel to, you know, have a lot of the vehicles switched over to natural gas?
Well, increasingly,
or is it mainly going to power plants or what?
Yeah, increasingly we are switching the major power plants and hopefully more and more vehicles to natural gas. Absolutely. The one concern which I have, I know it's premature, but in the long run, my prayer is that we're not going to become dependent upon natural gas and oil exports, but we will not become complacent as a result of that, because I think the greatness of the Jewish state in particular and Jews in general, that we have been historically very astute in recognizing that problems are challenges and therefore problems are opportunities in disguise. And therefore we have produced so much for humanity at large as well as for ourselves. I hope and pray that we're not going to put less emphasis on creativity and defiance of the cutting edge of nature only because we have some, suddenly we found this resource of natural gas.
Okay.
Tourism, sir, at your point, I've been 26 times to Israel.
Well, 26 times?
26 times to Israel, yes.
That's a very significant number because in Hebrew, 26 is the numerical value of the four letters of God. Jehovah in Hebrew equals to 26.
Interesting. Bill Koenig, question. It's my understanding that part of the Geneva talks included some kind of agreement or meeting in January with Syria. Is that accurate? And if so, what do you anticipate coming out as a result of these talks in Syria, and how do they match up, or what do they have to do with the Geneva talks with Iran?
I don't know if they're connected, but I think it's January 22nd when the Syrian talks are supposed to move forward, obviously with a major Russian influence. I was at a Herzliya conference, a counterterrorism conference in September in Israel, and the situation in Syria is very, very serious. You have an Islamic war. You got the who's who of radical Islamists operating inside of Syria. You have the thuggery that's taking place even against each other, the rebel groups, is so hard for us to comprehend, the violence and everything else. Assad obviously is backed heavily by Russia and Iran. Russia is specifically backing Assad primarily because they don't want to see that radical Islam spread from the rebel groups that could possibly get Islamic rebel groups that could possibly get control of Syria, and then see that move into the Islamic countries in the former Soviet Union countries. So the guys that briefed it were from Washington and also European think tanks, and they said this is a new radical Islamic battlefield, similar to Afghanistan, similar to Pakistan, but they were extremely concerned because it's right next to Israel. And what I mentioned tonight is people in Washington and supporters of Israel are really furious at the fact that the Pentagon would leak information out, where it's obvious that Israel probably took out the convoys, but that they would actually leak that information to the public and turn the focus on on Israel because of what happened inside of Syria. You look at Isaiah 17:1. It talks about the day that Damascus will no longer exist as a city. That's never been fulfilled. The situation there is extremely serious, extremely critical. It's kind of status quo right now. No one's really gaining, no one's losing, it appears. But Assad will probably stay there for a long, long time, especially if he has the Russian support and the Chinese support. But it's a very serious playground, and obviously from Israel's standpoint, they got to keep those chemical weapons away from Hezbollah to get in those missiles and rockets that are on the northern border of Israel.
So Obama's really stabbing Israel in the back instead of watching their back.
Yeah.
Next.
I would like, if possible, just to add few more comments on the Geneva Agreement. What that agreement has probably done was to transform Iran from a status of a limited tactical threat, which is controllable by the U.S., into a potentially strategic, uncontrollable, apocalyptic threat, which would not be controllable by the U.S. What that agreement has done is to defy common sense, in the reality whereby the U.S. negotiates with Iran while Iran is heavily behind the killing of Americans in Afghanistan, heavily involved in traumatizing subversion, terrorizing Bahrain especially, but also Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states with an aim to undermine American interests. Iran, which at the same time collaborate with Venezuela in undermining American position in Latin America. Iran, which at the same time is the chief patron of anti-American Islamic terrorism, and Iran, which only recently has expanded its cooperation with North Korea to develop long-range missiles able to hit the U.S., but they are negotiating with the U.S. and are perceived to be potentially a peaceful partner. And certainly, when you examine the track record of U.S. dealing with the rogue regime of Iran, you cannot escape the conclusion that the U.S. administration is determined to learn from history by repeating rather than avoiding past mistakes, which were evident in the debacle of the negotiation with North Korea. And as many of you may know, this should not be a surprise, because the chief negotiator for President Clinton with North Korea, Wendy Sherman, is the same person who today leads the negotiation with Iran. And I assume that she was given another chance to prove that she is not such a devastating failure as she was dealing with North Korea.
All right. That wasn't so optimistic, I don't think. This is mainly for Mr. Edinger, but you can answer too. There's two parts. One question I have: during the tribulation, it doesn't appear that Israel has many friends. And right now, what friends does Israel have with governments? And another question, second question is, how is...
I didn't get the first question.
Okay. What countries are friendly with Israel right now, the governments around the world?
There is one effective ally, and that's the U.S. The rest have to be taken with a big deal of grain of salt. Canada, by the way, Steve Harper, terrific guy, but again, Canada is limited in its involvement by choice. But as far as the superpowers, as far as the major powers involved in the Middle East, there's no doubt Europe are not dependable allies of Israel on a rainy day. U.S. maybe, but my advice to my friends in Jerusalem, as a person, and I think you could sense it, who deeply, deeply appreciate the U.S., but to be a worthy ally of the U.S., we should not depend on the U.S., but we should depend on ourselves. And if the U.S. comes along, great. But a dependable ally does not depend on somebody else to snatch us from jaws of defeat.
Yeah, you forgot Micronesia.
Pardon me?
You forgot Micronesia. Mm-hmm.
They are the subtle allies.
they're a faithful ally.
Subtle but appreciative. But, you know, the thing is with Israel, they have an amazing military, incredible sophistication. But they've had their arms tied, at least one arm tied behind their back for years. You know, every time when Israel over the years, especially when they had the suicide bombings and the terrorism around the country, it never failed. The United States says, Israel, be careful. Don't hit them too hard. Don't hit the Palestinians too hard, because it might affect your chances of making peace with the Palestinians. They said it over and over again. So I agree with you, Armin. The opportunity, there will be an opportunity for Israel to take care of business on their own and do as they determine is necessary, and things will work out well. The United States, all they do, this whole peace process, has empowered the terrorist organizations that are threats to Israel, that are now threats to Europe, that are now threats to the United States. This whole peace process has empowered the terrorist organizations like Hezbollah, Hamas, and all these other splinter radical groups throughout the Middle East. So at some point, Israel's going to say, hey, look, we can't rely on anybody but ourselves, and they'll take care of business.
Let me ask, I guess both of y'all can answer this, but Yoram especially. If Israel were to attack Iran, what would they have to do, you know, both against Hezbollah, Hamas, people inside Israel, you know, and over in Iran to have a successful attack?
You know, when I was consul general here, I spent some time in West Texas, and some people here probably know the area. West Texas is a place where sometime you're smothered by very powerful sandstorms. And one time I rented a car in Lubbock going up north to Amarillo. Coming from the Israeli consulate, I rented the smallest car due to our budget. And the manager at the car rental office said, "Sir, I want you to know that you may hit some smothering sandstorms, so listen to this advice. When smothered by West Texas sandstorms, don't pay attention to the tumbleweeds." And the same thing applies to Israel. When we are talking about the Iranian smothering sandstorms, we should not be preoccupied with the tumbleweeds of Hezbollah and Hamas. And there is a reason for that. Why is there a reason for that? Because when you compare the worst case scenario of retaliatory acts by Hamas and Hezbollah, which personally I doubt, but we'll take the worst case scenario, it's all dwarfed by one nuclear warhead. So why should we even waste any time to think about the cost of action when we know the deadly cost of inaction? And that, by the way, was the factor which motivated the late Prime Minister Begin to act against Iraq in defiance of some of the top intelligence people from the Mossad and from the IDF and other branches of our national security, who opposed the bombing of the Iraqi nuclear reactor, and who told him that the chance of success were anywhere between slim and none, that a rupture with the U.S. may develop, which may never be healed, and an all-out Islamic war would be launched on Israel, and the globe will boycott Israel, and Israel would crumble economically and socially, and Jews will leave Israel in huge numbers. And Begin heard it, and at the end of their presentation, and I heard, by the way, from a person who was at the room at the time, the lead pilot, and he said, Mr. Begin got up and he said, "I cannot dispute a single assessment that you made, and I commend you," he said, "for very lucid presentation of very logical situation and assessment, but you failed to share with me one item, and that's the cost of inaction. And if we all agree that the minimal cost or the realistic cost of inaction could be one nuclear warhead, why are we wasting time on such elements that you have mentioned?"
Okay, but my question was, what would they have to do? You know, would they have to deal with the 10,000 or however many rockets in southern Lebanon with ground forces? Would they have to, you know, use cruise missiles and then go in and, you know, I was asking
Tommy,
that.
Tommy, we're talking about two surrogates of Iran, Hamas and Hezbollah. The logical assumption is that should Israel preempt, and should the preemption be, as I expect, as we expect, successful, then those two small terrorist elements would be denied of a support by their most important patron. Under such conditions, what would be the chance that they would flex a muscle? And if they flex a muscle, how sizable would it be, knowing that if we are willing to go so far as to hit Iran, what would should they expect if they launch missiles at Israel? But as I said, even if I am overly naive and optimistic, etc., even then, 60,000, 80,000 Hamas Hezbollah missiles on Israel would be dwarfed by one nuclear warhead
yes.
from Iran.
Okay, so the nuclear threat, you think, would shut their rhetoric and a lot of their action down, like one on Qum, you know, their holy city or something like that?
Well, I think that if we, either U.S. or Israel, take on Iran, what would be targeted would be the nuclear infrastructure. You don't need to devastate the whole nuclear infrastructure. You need to focus on the sensitive 20%, 30% of that infrastructure, and we do have the means to do that. Some people tell me, well, don't brag so much because don't we know, the people in Washington telling me, don't we know what you are allowed to receive from the U.S. as far as bunker busters, and don't we know that that which you receive does not amount to the capability required to reach as deep as they have their installations? Well, the problem with such an assessment is that people don't realize. The minute we get the equipment from the U.S., a process of modification and upgrade starts. And unfortunately, we do have the experience, and we do have, therefore, the capabilities, and therefore, as I mentioned before, we later on share it with the manufacturer and show them how what they manufacture could be dramatically enhanced. And therefore, we do have the capabilities, and I hope and pray that we'll prove that we also have the backbone to realize those capabilities.
Since Israel is one of the few countries that has a neutron bomb, do they have anything like a neutron bunker buster bomb? You don't know? Okay.
Yeah. Did you see that look?
Go ahead. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Danny Burrows from Kilgore, Texas. Thank you so much for an educational presentation. This question is for you, Bill. What is the word about town concerning the discipline, removal, and or non-judicial punishment of our senior generals and flag officers?
In my news report a couple weeks ago, I think there's over 200 high-profile military leaders.
I saw 250.
Yeah, I think it's at 250 right now. We're talking about generals, admirals. There's a purging going on in the military right now that's extraordinary. I mean, it's so significant. General Boykin, you know, one of our favorites, has been talking a lot about that lately. He's written a couple articles about this. I mean, this is an unprecedented purging of our military by Obama and Hagel. So, you know, in key places, Manning or nuclear arms in other places. I won't go into all the details right now, but if you went into Google and put the purging of U.S. generals from the military, it's a long, long list of people that have been in very key positions. One example, I think Bush had two commanders in Afghanistan during his 7 years of dealing with it, and Obama's had a different one every single year. You know, we're seeing generals with distinguished careers leaving the military or being squeezed out of the military. This is very problematic. This is obviously General Boykin and other experienced military leaders that are conservative, and they're very concerned about this. But it's getting exposed. It should be exposed much more. But unfortunately, it's only WorldNet Daily, ourselves, and a few others that are actually exposing it. This is a very significant long-term strategic problem. Another example of the type of leadership we have in Washington.
Yeah, and article I read said that this was an assessment by a general, a retired general, that
right.
It's the issue is, will you carry out Obama's orders basically no matter what, or would you hesitate, you know, for ethical reasons? It seems to be the criteria.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something there. And I didn't appreciate either the pressure the commander-in-chief put on the military to get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I really didn't appreciate that. And I know a lot of other Christians, a lot of other friends of ours in the Jewish community didn't appreciate that either. But and also we've had a lot of chaplains that have left the military because of the pressure from Obama administration and people he has in key positions at the Pentagon. It's a very disruptive force that we have at the White House right now, and it just continues.
Yes, Bill, this is primarily for you, and we appreciate all you do up there in a very tight spot. And Mr. Ettinger, thank you so much for being a part of this event with us. We've really enjoyed having you with us, have we not? He's been very enlightening, and you may want... Hey, man. You may want to weigh in on this, or you may want to not weigh in on this question. And I'm Joe Vancouvering from God's News. We know one another. Okay. When this president began to run, the story was he was raised Muslim and converted to Christianity. The thought, the worry, the rumor has always been there in the background that this man has lied from the very beginning about his faith. And there's been numerous things over the years that have sort of come to the surface. I won't catalog all of them, but I could mention a number of them. I remember even a little over 2 years ago, one of my sources contacted me and said, Joe, Obama has got a Muslim prayer rug right off of the Oval Office, and he uses it. There was other things that began to come out. This has been a worry, a concern from the very outset. 4 weeks ago, I was in a prophecy conference in Louisiana with a pastor who I've known for over 15 years. Impeccable integrity, trusted, personal friend, a man of God. His brother has been White House security and police since Bush 1. He served with Bush 1, Clinton, Bush 2, and when Obama came into office, he said, I want to be reassigned. He was reassigned for several years. They finally paid him much more and talked him into coming back. They wanted him back so bad. He literally is in the White House constantly. Obviously, I'm not going to go there, and I'll never be in the Oval Office, but you have more access there than the rest of us in this room. Now, here's what he told me. This pastor was sent a picture from his brother's cell phone. Earlier this year, Obama had some meeting, some gathering with some Islamic envoy, two or three or four, I don't know the number. And I'm just saying, he wouldn't show me the picture because his word was out to his brother. But this is a man of impeccable integrity that I've known for 15 years. He said, Joe, trust me, I've got the picture. And it shows Obama and four or five other Muslims in the Oval Office on their Islamic prayer rugs praying at some holy day or some holy moment in Islam. The question, I guess, is, you always give us information, maybe I'm giving you some, I don't know. The thing is how would, you have to get asked this question a lot. This isn't the first time I'm sure you've heard it. Any thoughts, anything you can say? Obviously, we don't want you fired or out of there or anything like that, or, you know, people taking your life, but I believe this man, and I believe that's the last thing. I mean, I heard reports before, but I never had concrete evidence from someone that wasn't just hearsay, and I don't take this as hearsay. I believe it. Comments or thoughts or add to it or help us?
Well, Joe, obviously I have to be sensitive to what I say publicly and on tape. There's plenty of news out there. I know WorldNet Daily, Joe Cifera, I appreciate his guts and some of the reporting that they have had on this subject for quite a while. Steve Emerson and John Rossmondo. Steve Emerson was the first, matter of fact, he's Jewish, and he went into a mosque many years ago and heard this incredible, radical Islamic talk in a mosque here in America. So if you all want to go into the Internet, Steve Emerson and John Rossmondo, M-A-N-D-O, they're doing some incredible work right now in this particular area. Their investigative reporters probably have as much cutting-edge stuff as anybody else. Obviously, there's concern about Obama's background, the ring he wears, his history, conversation that he supposedly had with the Egyptian foreign minister a few years ago when he was in Cairo, Egypt, in June 4, 2009.
Show him your brother.
Right? Yeah. Also, yeah. My website. I took his June 4, 2009 speech, paragraph by paragraph, and analyzed every single part of it. It was an apologetic type address. It was not accurate. It was equating the Quran to the Bible. I mean, in terms of magnitude and significance, and even saying that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams had a copy of the Quran. He failed to say the reason they had a copy of the Quran. They were trying to figure out these Barbary pirates and what made them tick. That's why they had the Quran. So there's a lot of things about him. I know about the only time he goes to church is when people start questioning his faith publicly. Then he goes to the church and is the 80% of the media that favors him goes and shows, look, he's a Christian, just went to church this weekend. And that's about the last time you'll see him. You won't see him in church again for a long period of time.
He golfs a lot, though.
What's that?
He golfs a lot, doesn't he? Yeah.
He does. Exactly. He golfs a ton. He golfs a ton. And, you know, we're watching this all carefully. You know, these are all final day players in God's scheme. We sure, all of us in this room, have a faith in the God of Israel. And he's going to bring darkness to light. Obviously, some things that have happened this year and since he made the declaration that he has Israel's back when it comes to national security is obviously a concern. So, who does he select for office? These are things you can see. There's patterns in his behavior. There's people he selects that are obviously very problematic to us. So there's a lot of stuff on the Internet that's even credible. You know, there's a lot, let me put it this way, there's a lot that isn't. But there is incredible information on the Internet that connect the dots. And I think that's what we try to do with our news service. So we are still watching that with great interest. I know some Christian leaders had a meeting with him before he ran for office. And they said, this man believes there's many paths to God. He doesn't believe there's one path to God. He also was told in Chicago, when he was in Chicago, that, look, if you're going to be involved in political office in Chicago, you got to be in church.
Absolutely.
So I picked Reverend Wright's church.
Yep.
And we've heard a lot of stories about Reverend Wright's church and heard Reverend Wright. So we're continuing to watch these people very closely.
Well, for me, Bill, this was the last piece of information I needed to solidify it in my mind, because this wasn't hearsay. The guy has got the picture. Bless you, and thank you for all
you
do.
Appreciate it.
Cindy Fields, Montgomery, Texas. This is for Bill. As a mother of a Marine, I'm asking. Number one question is there anybody in Congress or in the administration with the backbone to stand up to anyone there about Israel? And number two question is, are we going to get any answer on Benghazi? Or is all this that we're doing just a dog and pony show, that we're not going to get any answers and we're not, you know, our boys, our men and women over there are not getting the backup and the support that they need?
Well, this is we're in a very disruptive period in our country. It's one problem after another. You know, Benghazi was a big thing. Then it was the eavesdropping on my friend James Rosen with Fox News and some other media people in Washington. Then it was on the IRS focus on the Tea Party and conservative Christian groups. And then the Obamacare was thrown in there. It's just one thing after another. It's hard to believe that we're only 10, almost 11 months into his final term. It feels like we're at the end of 4 years. And then to see what's happened here recently with the situation with the P5 plus one negotiations there with Iran and Geneva. You know, some days you really feel like things are getting out of control. And we know if Europe presses it with Israel, watch their economy. They're gonna feel it. They have a very volatile, fragile economy right now. That whole continent has its issues. The only reason our economy hasn't done anything significantly is because the Federal Reserve has thrown $4 trillion at this. With this $80 to $90 billion a month quantitative easing, this whole stock market, only a small percentage of people have benefited from it, and it's a false sense of security. And we have, you know, $4 trillion more in Federal Reserve. We're at $17.3 billion now in debt. I'm a trillion. Yeah, big difference. We've got a lot of issues facing our country, and unfortunately, this is a wag the dog thing. Let's get the focus off Obamacare disaster, and let's go get involved with peace talks with Iran, like the Saudi prince said. I mean, this is a scary situation with a scary guy right now that's doing everything he can to get the focus off all his improprieties and mistakes. So, with all that said. You know, I don't know what's going to surface. We don't have any real, truly strong statesmen on Capitol Hill. I like Senator Cruz a lot. The guy is right on, spot on, and courageous. Yoram's had the chance to meet with his father recently. These are solid guys that think clearly. Cruz is so brilliant. I mean, you compare what Cruz has done with his life and what Obama's done, there's no competition. And, you know, there's Issa and... you know, canter occasionally, but we really need some strong leadership. Because the bottom line, if any Republican president had done even an inkling of what Obama's done, they'd already be back at home. And this guy has had, you know, he's got the Senate majority, and he's got about 80% of the media on his side. So we haven't been able to really oust him at this point, based on so many things going on.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
For Mr. Ellinger, we've been told that the Israeli government is pretty secular. Do you have a concept of the approximate percentage of people in the government there, in the decision-making area, who are believing Jews rather than secular Jews?
When it comes to defining Jews as secular or religious, when it comes to Jews in Israel, one has to apply different standards of measurements than applicable to Western societies. And I'll give you an example. The mayor of Tel Aviv, who was just re-elected, I believe, for his third or fourth term, I happened to know him personally, very left, I would even say emotionally flaming left, flaming secular, flaming anti-religion, but during the last 10 years or so, he has been the sponsor of special nights on the eve of holiday of Pentecost for studying the Torah and the nature of the holiday of Pentecost. As far as he is concerned, Ron Huldai, that's his name, as far as he is concerned, that's no religion. This is Jewish culture. We have in Tel Aviv, in the last 2 or 3 years, again, sponsored by him, more and more secular homes invite secular people to study how to welcome the Sabbath. And those sessions are conducted by young rabbis, hired, paid by the municipality to teach more and more secular Jews about the Sabbath from what they call the cultural point of view. It's a religious, but as far as he's concerned, it's culture. When it comes to Yom Kippur in Israel, it's not a fast day for religious people alone. The vast, vast, vast majority of secular Jews fast on Yom Kippur. And those who do not fast do not do it publicly. They would eat at their home. Certainly nobody dares even to think about driving or opening a shop or restaurant or coffee shop or entertainment, etc. Comes the eve of Passover, the vast majority of the country, secular and religious alike, are around the table retelling the story of the Exodus. And while certainly most people don't build the Sukkah, the tabernacles during the whole day of tabernacles, but most people do pay a visit during one of the days of the holiday to their friends who do have it in order to experience an evening within this Sukkah. Why? Because this is again the retelling of the story of the wandering in the desert during the Exodus. The same thing applies to every more secular holiday like the one which we're just concluding tomorrow, Hanukkah. Hanukkah is not a religious holiday in the mind of the vast majority of secular Jews. As far as secular Jews are concerned, it's our culture. And therefore, while most people in Israel, like myself, are secular, but like myself, there are many secular who study the holidays, who study the portion of the week of the Torah which we read every single week. We do it as secular Jews, which under American standards, the European, would classify it as at least religious light, if not even more than religious light. By the way, this goes back to my reference to Jewish demography, because the question should be asked, how come Jewish demography is surging while Western demographies are receding or stagnant? It has to do with the natural compatibility between fertility on one hand and attachment to roots on the other hand. The more you are attached to your roots, the more you want to produce more babies who will cultivate those roots. Most secular people are very much attached to our roots. Hawks or doves or liberal, conservative, attachment to roots is second nature in Israel. There is compatibility between fertility rate and communal responsibility. Most people do display in Israel communal responsibility. Just to share with you an anecdote, I show my demographic data on a daily basis to movers and shakers in Israel at a PowerPoint, which I share with people. And I did that presentation to one of the leading TV folks in Israel. Some of you may watch it, maybe Channel 2, Udi Segal. Udi Segal is a great guy, but what can I do? What can I say? He's a typical cosmopolitan, liberal, peacenik, secular, probably does not like very much religious people. And I showed him my PowerPoint presentation, and when we came to the frame, which shows the 62% surge in the annual number of Jewish babies from 1995 to 2012, he said, Yoram, this is me. I said, what do you mean this is you? He said, well, I didn't tell you, but my wife and I are contemplating a fourth child. So I asked him, why do you want a fourth child? He was thinking, and then without a smirk on the face, very serious face, he said, you know, Yoram, maybe this is our Zionist statement. Now, the Udi Segal of New York Times, Washington Post, MSNBC, the Daily Telegraph in London, the Figaro in Le Monde in France, would never think about producing a baby for the well-being of the French people, the British people, the American people. But the very, very left, liberal, peace cosmopolitan reporter in Israel, for him, it's obvious. Let's produce one for Zionism. That's the difference between, again, Jews and other Western societies, and maybe it's also a secret for our success of the last 4,000 years of Jewish history.
That's better than here.
Udi.
Yeah, I know
him. Oh, you know him?
Yeah,
Bill, can I ask you one quick question?
Sure.
We've heard about Kerry and Cagle and all these other folks who are so anti-Semitic. I understand that people hear what they want to hear, and they disregard the rest. But Are these people completely ignorant of the things that we've been taught here? Or are they just, they ignore it? Have they been exposed to it?
As far as the biblical?
Well, as far as the legality of Israel, as far as the history of Israel being entitled to a huge amount of land that they've been robbed of.
Yeah, that's a great question. What has happened? The whole peace process, well, we can even look back to the reneging of Balfour and League of Nations, United Nations, and all those things over time, is the oil lobby. The people that produce oil in the Middle East have told the Western community, the United States and the Europeans, they want this land back. They want this land. I mean, you heard an incredible presentation last night, and you've heard incredible presentations during this conference. We have the biblical right and the legal right and the practical right and the strategic right to this land. No one cares, or very, very few people care, but us. The international community looks at Israel as a wonderful, productive country, but at the same time, I mean, these are maybe expendable. I mean, it makes no sense. I mean, there is an example in a country in the Middle East that you truly have peace within an Arab country. It's Shiites versus Sunnis. It's Sunni versus Sunnis. It's Shia versus Shia. It's tribal factions. It's secular. It's a mess in most countries in the Middle East. And they expect Israel to make peace with a country that won't even acknowledge their right to exist or won't acknowledge them as a Jewish state. But we keep pushing and we keep pushing, which only makes things worse. This is Bible prophecy playing out. I mean, this is happening. The Jewish prophets of the Tanakh, of the Old Testament, have talked about a time like this. We just happen to be living in that time. And Jerusalem is a time clock. Every nation in the world wants to divide the city of Jerusalem and give Judea and Samaria for the future of an Arab state. I mean, the heart of God's promised land to be an Arab state? So anyhow, that's from that perspective, but at the same time, they just don't care.
I would like to add an element here. One, in my mind, should not focus on how do Carey or Hegel feel about Israel. The real question for Americans is, how does it impact the U.S. and not Israel? And when you examine not only John Kerry and Chuck Hagel, but the so-called foreign policy establishment in this country, which is basically a derivative of the so-called coastal elites, East Coast especially, but also West Coast so-called elites, you'll find out, first of all, when it comes to U.S.-Israel relations, that the unbelievable enhancement of strategic cooperation between 48 and today has taken place either independent of those elites or in defiance of those elites, never because of those elites. That's number one. Number two, you examine the track record of the foreign policy establishment of this country. Before 48 and since 48, the establishment did not want a Jewish state. The brutal pressure on Ben-Gurion was initiated by the Department of State and the intellectuals of the U.S., by the way, co-led by the New York Times those days. And one of the very, very simplistic arguments which sheds light on the gullibility of those elites until this very day, by the way, one of the arguments then was, well, the founding fathers were born in East Europe. That means that they would align themselves with the Soviet Union. Why should we lend a hand to a future communist state? Later on, that establishment was courting President Nasser of Egypt. The more they courted him, the closer he got into the embrace of the Soviet Union. The same establishment stabbed the back of the Shah of Iran and courted the old man in exile in Paris. And that establishment condemned the Shah for being ruthless leader and complimented the old man who simply wants seeking. He was seeking human rights, supposedly. We're talking about establishment which courted Saddam Hussein under the ignoramus oversimplified assumption that the enemy of my enemy must be my friend. Never occurred to them that enemy of my enemy could be my enemy as well. Now, those days I was at the embassy in Washington. I still had my briefcase from my days in Houston, Texas, and there was the bumper sticker, "Don't mess with Texas." And I have my boots, and the administration folks and some people also in the media were very upset with that Israeli cowboy who does not recognize, I'm talking about 1990, a few months before the invasion of Iraq, does not recognize that there is a new world order. He still speaks like an old Cold War warrior. And when I mentioned that Saddam Hussein is threatening Kuwait, and this could be a major blow to American treasury and American national security, I remember one time this laugh. Ha! Look at those right-wingers in Israel. How slick they are to get off the hook of conducting peace negotiation with the Palestinians. They talk about the threat of Saddam Hussein. And it was the same elite that pressured both Israel and the Palestinian Authority to allow Hamas to run during the election and cause the rise of Hamas. It was the same elite that welcomed Bashar Assad as a fresh phenomena of reformist younger generation. Why? Because they say he's a doctor. That's already a definite direction towards moderation. And he was educated and practiced in London. And my goodness, he was the president of the Syrian Internet Society. And most importantly, as far as categorizing one as moderate or radical, he is married to a very modern-minded, Western-minded Syrian woman. Now, what better qualifications does one have than those to be defined as a moderate constructionist reformer? And those were the exact adjective used by John Kerry and Chuck Hagel, who belong to the very, 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 very tiny club on the hill, which were the aficionado of the Bashar, of the Assad family, first of Hafez Assad and then of the son Assad. And last and not least, this is the same type of thinking of those elites and the derivative, which is the Department of State. For this reason, that we know why they're called Froggy Button. There is some fogginess over there. But those are the same elites who welcomed what they call the Arab Spring, which is an Arab tsunami, as transition to democracy. I remember the president, Hillary Clinton, talking about the reincarnation of MLK and Mahatma Gandhi on the streets of Egypt. And they have ignored completely the reality of the Middle East, and in the process, they facilitated the rise of the anti-American Muslim Brotherhood. They facilitated the demise of very, very bad Gaddafi just to bring a much worse regime today in Libya. They accorded Putin an unexpected benefit, bonus in Syria, which Putin never expected, and they also managed to instill panic in the mind of their allies in the Persian Gulf. So why should anybody be surprised that the same people have also concocted the Geneva Agreement with Iran? It's natural.
A couple questions for both of you. Israel's weapons system, we hear a lot about EMPs. Israel's got that technology also. Would that, in your estimation, be something that they might employ in a Iran attack? The second thing is on the economy.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat, but in a louder voice?
Okay. The EMP weapons system, Israel's got that. Would that be a possible scenario that they might use? And the second question is, the economy. We've heard for years that our economy is going to collapse. Can this economy go another 5, 10, 20 years, and how would that affect the churches, and also how would that affect Israel?
On the EMP, EMP America, it's a panel of some former generals, also CIA Director James Woolsey and some others that are doing. I went to the first briefing that they had on the at the UN, not at the UN, but on the fringe of the UN in 2 years ago, and they were attempting to get Congress to appropriate $5 billion to reinforce our power grids. I think America has five total, four across the country, and then one in Texas. Texas has its own power grid. So these were some high-level generals, CIA folks. They were doing everything they could to, number one, discuss the importance of EMP. Also the fact that they also had a former CIA guy who, that worked inside of Iran, that Iran is spending a tremendous amount of money perfecting electromagnetic pulse that would be focused and pointed at the refineries in northeast Saudi Arabia, and also the missile capability. You have to shoot it up. I think it's a couple hundred miles above the atmosphere. Like a nuclear type event, and then it will rain down and fry the transistors. And I've seen some scenarios that were is actually congressional testimony that says if an effective EMP attack over America would put us back into the 1900s and early late 1800s. I mean, it would be devastating. Actually, 1900s. It would be devastating. That most of America couldn't survive after 12 months of a very serious EMP attack in America. So they are perfecting it. Iran's perfecting it for the sake of the threat against Saudi Arabia, possibility of using it against Israel, but Israel has their own ways of handling that, and also the possibility of using it eventually against the United States. For many of us, we take God's security for granted. You know, I think that's part of the problem we have in America. Most people say, oh, it will work out. Things always work out. That'll never happen in America. It just won't come here. I remember hearing Avi Lipkin in 1998 talking about the day that radical Islam was going to come to America. And it was, you know, I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was over here in Arlington. Avi was giving a presentation on radical Islam and the fact it was coming to America, that one day we were going to have to contend with it. I couldn't comprehend that. Not America, not our country, no way. But then Avi, a couple months before the 9/11 event, 9/11-2001 event, was on a program, I think it was with Missler, talking about the possibility of bringing commercial jets one day into buildings in America. And all of a sudden, life as we know it in America changed on 9/11-2001. The enemies that Israel faces is now the enemies that the Europeans face, the United States faces, and even Russia. Things have changed dramatically. So I think EMP is a very significant potential effect. Only WorldNet Daily and a couple people will even write about it in Newsmax. Other than that, you won't see it in most major newspapers in America. A quick note here on our economy. You know, we just keep kicking the can down the road. Quantitative easing. I heard it from a guy the other day that's associated with the Federal Reserve, who used to be with the Federal Reserve, says this is an absolute total bailout of the banks and Wall Street. This enormous amount of money has bailed them out, and very few people have benefited from that. Our massive debt, I mean, our national federal debt, by the time Obama is scheduled to leave office, will have doubled while he's in office. You know, how long can we sustain this? And then with Obamacare, I mean, that cost is going to, insurance companies are in the business of making money. They're going to dump that cost on a weak population that's struggling, making ends meet, and it's going to have effect. And Obama's line over and over, I hear from his press secretary almost every time, almost every press briefing, is he's concerned about the middle class. Well, his policies are devastating the middle class in America. And we haven't seen anything yet. So this is an absolute, total lie that he is trying to protect the middle class. EPA, Obamacare, all of that is to get put more control in the hands of the government. So we got some tough times ahead.
His question was whether Israel would use a EMP over Iran.
This is not my expertise, and okay. I wouldn't even care to comment.
I would have to believe that Israel has EMP capacity.
I think they have a secret weapon, too. I think Israel, you know, the God of Israel, is and like Yoram said tonight, you know, they perfect our weapons. The God of Israel gives them incredible ingenuity, and they perfect the weapons. And I don't think there's any, and this is a fun talk amongst Christians and Jews here, is I really believe that Israel has an incredible, breathtaking response to anything that Iran dishes out. Iran are it's a very capable foe, but the God of Israel is with the nation of Israel, and they will respond, and it will be devastating.
Listen, I want to thank you guys. This has been wonderful. And this is really kind of a more of a comment maybe than a question. You know, I hear so often from the media, well, Obama is inexperienced and he just doesn't get it. He's naive. And, you know, honestly, I find solace in that. Oh, well, maybe he is inexperienced. I guess my comment is, maybe he isn't. I mean, maybe he has an agenda. Maybe he knows exactly what he's doing. Carolyn Glick says his foreign policy is to weaken Israel. Well, what's his policy here? To weaken America? I can't believe that. You know, I just don't even believe we're going to be able to recognize this country after, you know, his term is over. And one more thing. You know, we're hearing so much about Obamacare. We're hearing so much about Benghazi. And I almost feel like these are smoke screens. What's really going down? I mean, what are the things that are coming in that we don't have a clue that will take us totally by surprise?
Well, I will have only one comment. I don't think there is a reason for you to be concerned about America, because as an Israeli say, you have, we have your back, right?
Well, I just wanted to kind of get your opinion on some things I've been reading on the internet and hearing in the news. Does Obama deserve a third term? And for, you know, when I first started hearing that, I thought, well, now, wait a minute. Our Constitution says that a president can only serve two terms. But then what about him invoking martial law in order to stay in office? This is a concern, I think, that the American people have, and if you have a comment on it, I'd like to hear it.
Well, it was interesting. We were hearing some of the same stuff when Bill Clinton was in office about him wanting to serve a third term. The thing is, Obama's executive orders have much, much, much more teeth than anything Clinton or Reagan or Bush operated under. And we wrote about it last year. The executive orders that he put in place, he basically could call for martial law without a national emergency. So, you know, we're watching this very, very closely. We have to be careful not to have overactive imagination. And I see that quite a bit on the internet. I think the best thing to do is go, what we're doing is going with the facts. Okay, this is his executive order. This is what he said. This is what it means. And here's our conclusion. So, the best thing to use is the, like Paul was using today, use the words of Obama, use the words of his staff, use the words of his Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, connect the dots and come up with a conclusion based on facts. And I think that's important. Yeah, we're, you know, if you see a disruption in the Persian oil, that could be devastating. Just think of when oil hit $140 in July of 2008, it devastated our economy. And it led to a major market meltdown. It led to two of our automobile companies filing for bankruptcy. It devastated banks. It had record home foreclosures, and that was only $140 oil for a little bit of a while. If you see a major disruption in the oil coming out of the Persian Gulf, which is 20 to 30% of the daily use of oil, that could have a devastating impact on already vulnerable economies. So with all that said, I think a lot of us are very suspect of this leadership in Washington, and alluding to the lady's comments back there, we have part of it looks diabolic, part of it looks naive, part of it is the bad decisions, and Washington has taken legislation and the word unintended consequences to a whole different level. They pass something, then read it. You know, like the Obamacare, let's go ahead and pass it, and then we need to read it to see what's in it. And then they go and try to fix it, and then to make it worse because they can't see past their nose. And 90% of the problems America is facing today started in Washington, D.C. And the flyover states, the people here in the middle of America have a lot better handle than the elites that Yoram was talking about in New York, on the East Coast and the West Coast. We have a lot better handle and a lot more practical. But the main thing is we don't have control of the courts right now, a lot of courts. We don't have control of some of the legislatures. We don't have control of the media. These are very challenging times for people that follow Judeo-Christian values and that care about the future of our country. This is a culture war in enormous capacity, enormous size. So only the Lord knows how this is going to play out. But we have also taken our security for granted in our country. You know, God could have stopped Obama from being elected in 08, and he sure could have stopped him in 2012. But he allowed him to be, with his sovereignty, he allowed him to be elected. So it's tough at times, but he's sovereign, and I accept that, and we certainly look forward to a change here fairly soon.
We got a lot of windmills.
And ethanol and all those other solutions.
The hour being late, in three sentences or less, are we less concerned about just the Pakistani nuclear weapons than the Iranian ones due to Iran's theological bent?
Unlike Pakistan, Iran harbors regional and more than regional megalomaniac imperialistic aspirations. Pakistan, just like North Korea, they wanted that for what they believe is their own national security. North Korea in face of the U.S., in South Korea, and Pakistan in face of its arch adversary enemy, India. For Iran, it serves an expansionist type of strategy, hence the very real threat from a nuclear Iran.
I have heard that the real issue going on in the Islamic world, you know, it, as you've alluded to, is a fight over Sunni versus Shia and who gets to reestablish the caliphate. I mean, what's your opinion of such a explanation?
Well, this has been the story of the Middle East going back to the 7th century. There has been nothing new in that regard. The Middle East has been a role model of fragmentation among Arabs, among Muslims, along religious lines, intra-Muslim religious lines, intra-Muslim ethnic, intra-Muslim geographic, intra-Muslim ideological lines, and also a role model of very violent intolerance between one another. It seems to me that after 1400 years of such practice, it's time for Western policymakers, Western public opinion molders to reach the conclusion that if that is the way they treat one another, what can the so-called infidel Christian, infidel Jew, infidel Hindu, infidel Buddhist, etc., what can we, the infidel, expect from them once they have the upper hand? And therefore, what should be done to avoid that type of a tragedy befalling upon the world of the infidel? And here I would like to conclude my role with an appeal to each one among you here. You're fortunate to reside in a country which has, in my mind, the best political system anywhere in the world. I know that it's a frustrating system sometimes, like now there is there are problems, how do we get out of this traffic, political traffic jam, etc. But this is a system which prevents dictatorship, prevents ruling of the ruthless ruling by majority against minority, etc. In that regard, you have, in addition to the executive, you have the legislature. And the legislature does heed the constituents. I know from my experience, since 1989, I've been in touch with the U.S. Congress. The notion of "we shall remember in November" reverberates in every corridor on Capitol Hill. And every office dreads that battle cry, "we shall remember in November," whether they are House members or senators. Because all of them are running every 2 years, even though senators are not running, they want to remain in the majority, so they're also running. What I'm saying is that you have power, and that power needs to be exercised through your legislators. And your legislators are co-equal, they are co-determining in this country. There is a reason why the Constitution has the legislature as the first article, and the executive is the second one. It wasn't a rather flip of a coin. There is a rationale, there is a common sense behind that order of priorities. And I hope that that which you have listened to in this highly instructive, educated conference, you'll share also at least some of it with your representatives in the House and in the Senate in Washington. And anyone here who thinks, who are we to have an impact? So I would like to quote an old friend of mine, the late, some of you may even know him, the late Mac Wallace. He was the railroad commissioner of Texas, from Athens, Texas, and not far from Kilgore. And Mac Wallace, in addition of being a super human being, was also the master of Texas colloquialism. And I remember one time when I spoke with him and I say, "Mac, I don't think that I can do it. I have to admit, I don't have the power to carry on this specific mission." And Mac said, "Yoram, sometimes even a blade of a grass can deflect a cannonball. Everybody here is more powerful than a blade of a grass, so you certainly can deflect a cannonball." Thank you.
Last question.
I really appreciate the discussion tonight. Thank both of you very much for that. It's been very helpful and enlightening. I just wanted to maybe ask you a question on a more hopeful note and maybe raise the conversation above the roof up here and go up a little bit. I know you believe this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, "Surely just as I have intended it, so it has happened, and just as I have planned it, so it will stand." And I heard, Bill, I think I heard you say that only God knows what's going to happen. I appreciate you putting that in, but Jesus said, "Behold, I've told you in advance," so we know too. And in the same passage, Matthew 24, he said, "Do not be frightened when all these things happen." Would you agree with that? And would you give us a parting word on that basis?
Yes. Obviously, the Lord has given us a roadmap. There's no doubt about it. But what's been interesting, Phil, is we're getting a new revelation in some of these scriptures. When you read a scripture about these times, about the days we're living in, we don't know the specific detail. We do know the end result. We do know what Bible prophecy says. We do know the nations that we ought to watch in the final days. I mean, our Jewish prophets in the Tanakh talk about the alignment of nations, the battles that Israel will face. But what I mean by only God knows is there's so many things in play right now, and they can go in so many different directions.
I mean, with the EU, with the Russia, Iran, one world political order, one world religious order, with the major church organizations, World Council churches coming against Israel, the Vatican with its history with Israel. We don't know how those dots are going to play out. We don't know how. We don't know the timing, and we don't know the specifics. I think we have a good general understanding, and we also know as believers that Yeshua is, according to the scriptures, is to come back to Jerusalem for a thousand-year millennial reign. That's in our Bible. That's what the Bible says. So that's when I say the God only God knows, Phil. I'm talking about the specifics and the intricacies and how one thing will play off another as we march toward those final battles and then Yeshua's return.
All I know is if something bad happens to me, I get to go to heaven. Let's pray. Father, we do thank you for giving us your revelation and giving us the roadmap, and we thank you that we can analyze what's going on and see where we are and things like that. And we pray that you would, we thank you for these speakers that we had tonight to help us in these areas. And we pray that you'd give us a good night's sleep as we complete the last part of our conference in the morning. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.